AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Hit or Miss Doctor Who, the podcast where we dive deep into the time vortex and try to avoid getting exterminated for our opinions. I am Mike, your usual host and your guide through time and space. And today we're continuing our Dalek deep dives with a story that redefined the Metal Menace for a new generation. That's right, we're heading back to 2005 or possibly 2012 for Dalek, the episode that introduced new Who audiences to a lone Pepper Pot with a serious superiority complex. As usual, I am joined by my partner in time, the ever-opinionated DK.
Hello there, Mike. Would you like me to see my paperback trick?
Is that the bit you're going to respond with, really?
it's what I could come up with, the spur of the moment.
Yes, audience.
It's your fault.
I was going to say, audience, if you're baffled, I've written in the script, let DK respond with banter or a bit. I don't know why, and that was the best we're going to get out of him. So, there you go. Oh, how are you doing, DK?
I'm okay.
You're looking forward to this one?
I am, actually. I actually put some work into this one.
Wow, cool.
Wow. Yeah, shit, nobody told me I had to do some work.
Trust me, when you finish this recording, you'll feel like you have been.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah. Believe. And joining us for this episode, we've got a familiar face back in the console room.
Hi.
He's here again.
Was this unnatural enough?
that was chiming in naturally. I'm happy enough for that.
Yeah. Utterly unnatural.
Jesus. Welcome back, Toby. And making her hit or miss debut, please welcome Morning. Jillian to the show. Welcome.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm in.
We've got a ton to get into. This episode obviously has trauma, sass, and very questionable museum ethics. But before that main review, we've got a couple of other fun podcast sections to navigate. So strap in and hold on to the console as we begin by going into the vortex. Into the vortex is basically a little bit of a getting to know you opening chat, just about various things, including the theme of the episodes we're going to be looking at. Now, Toby, I do know that you were on the last episode, so I did already ask you for your favourite kind of Doctor Who stories, how you were introduced to the show, what got you hooked, etc. But
if you ask for a favourite episode again, it's going to be different.
Really?
Wow. I don't know, because I don't keep track of this sort of stuff.
Well, there we go. I mean, it's always fun. You never know what you're going to get. But yes, Jill, as a first-time
Hello,
guest,
yes.
I feel obliged to ask you, can you remember the sort of the episode that got you hooked on Doctor Who, if it was the first episode you watched or, you know, or not?
Well, no, the first episode that got me hooked on Doctor Who was Genesis of the Daleks, which was replayed, wow. I think, in Five Faces. Or was it Doctor Who Monsters? One or the other. Five Faces or Doctor Who Monsters in 81, 82-ish.
Was that the kind of the full official version, or was it the kind of the omnibus cut-down version that you saw? Can you remember?
I think it was the full version, as far as I'm aware. Okay. I'd have to admit that I was five, so I couldn't possibly comment.
Couldn't remember, but you knew you liked it anyway.
I know I rushed out to buy the Doctor Who magazine, which of course was... For all of those who are excited by such things, issue 69. Yes, that's issue 69. My birthday was the month after, so I'm guessing that the repeat was in August, because the repeats usually were. And so we bought the first magazine in September, and my birthday happens to be in October for all of those of you who wish to buy me a birthday present. My parents bought me a subscription to the Doctor Who magazine, so I nice. Suspect it really was a major moment.
What was the first original one that you saw then?
Well, it's difficult to remember if I remember the repeat or the actual first showing, but I'd say it was Leisure Hive.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd say I have memories of Leisure Hive, but whether they I don't know if Leisure Hive was repeated.
Don't think so.
No, so that would be the first one I originally saw, which would be straight after the two repeats, I would presume. I'm guessing that Destiny and City were August, September time, and then the new series started in September proper.
Still kind of weird to me, but to get used to this idea, even though I know from, like, you know, watching the special features and stuff that there was repeats all the time because there wasn't, like, home media and stuff. But, like, yeah. To me, it's just like watch it once, buy it on DVD, Blu-ray, whatever. So,
oh, yeah, no. Well, it was a few years until I got some recording media, unfortunately.
Obviously, yeah. That's fair enough. So the next big question would have been, or will be, I should say, do you have a favourite classic Who and a favourite new Who story? And again, I said this last week, I'm not breaking new Who into two sections just because Russell T Davies decided to. New Who's everything from 2005. It's not a, you know, starting again with series one nonsense. Classic and Who, new, that's what
because
we're dealing
that's
with.
Stupid.
Yeah, exactly.
Classics probably, well, it's difficult. Well, I'm not going to go for Robots of Death. Caves comes close.
Okay.
Talons, obviously, Inferno, the usual. I'm really trad in my taste, I suspect. New Who is not something I've ever really got my head round, to be perfectly fair with you. 45 minutes is not a length I find appealing.
This episode review of 2005 Dalek is going to be fun.
I obviously worked on Blink, so I'll go with Blink.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, fair enough. How did you work on Blink? That's a story we have to hear, surely.
I work in sound. I was the sound assistant on Blink.
Oh, okay. Cool. Well, then, understandable you would pick that. Cool.
Yeah.
That's, 2 weeks in a row we've had somebody who's worked on Doctor Who come in on the podcast. I feel like I'm such a pleb just watching the damn thing.
But yeah.
You are.
I mean, yeah, but okay.
Yeah.
So the next question, I'll come to you first of all, Toby, because I'm going to ask you both, but, you know, feels like you've been quiet for a while. So given that we're looking at all things Dalek related this series, do you have a favourite Dalek story from the entire run of the show?
Well, good question. I don't know.
you really struggle to think.
I need a list. Wait a minute.
Well, if you want to describe the episode, I can tell you what the title is. You don't have to worry about the exact titling or anything, you know.
Oh, okay. I really like Magician's Apprentice, Mitch Familiar. Only for Misty, because she is a vibe.
Yeah, I can understand that. That's fair. I actually really like that two-parter as well. That's the start of Series 9, Peter Capaldi, etc. So, yeah, okay, cool. An interesting choice. And Jill, I'm guessing yours is probably going to be a classic too, judging by your...
I mean, let's be honest, it's going to be Genesis for you know, reasons of memory, which I think is fair. Nostalgia does have a place in it in this world.
So we're going to move on to the next section. The next section is the one that gives the podcast its name. It's the hit or miss section.
How I hate these hit or miss performances.
Oh, this is sometimes referred to as the dreaded hit or miss, because I'm guessing you guys don't know what to expect, even though Toby should by now. So just to give you guys...
Direct me.
Just to give you guys a quick explanation and to give the audience a refresher if people don't know. The hit or miss section is basically where I pick random things from anywhere in the Hooniverse, shout them out, ask you if they're a hit or a miss in your opinion, debate back and forth if necessary, and then come to a conclusion, a concession between us, and yeah, then close the door on that. So, and because we're doing Dalek-themed episodes and stories, there will be a lot of that sprinkled into the hit or miss section as well, just because, you know, it makes sense to keep the theme running. So, speaking of which, and I've been dying to get to this to start this section, because this not only is related to the Daleks, but very much relates to a complaint that you literally just made, Jill. So I can't wait to see the thoughts on this one. So starting with hit or miss for the episodes, Bad Wolf and the Parting of the Ways. And I have to come to you first, Gillian, who just said that Russell T Davies cannot finish a series.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. At the time, when I first watched it, there was some spitting, to be fair. But I have since come to terms with it and can see the positive aspects of it. But yeah, the end, hell of a cop-out. I mean, there are so many things in season one that are building up. The fact that Daleks should be made out of Daleks, and then they're not, as you can clearly see, because they're being taken from the Big Brother house. So they're made of humans. So is this going to be a big factor? Oh, I was really excited. What's the next episode going to bring? And Rose looks into the computer and presses reset. It's the most disappointed I was, because I hadn't realised that Russell was just going to piss it up the wall, really, which is what he always does. But once you got past the fact that, you know, the end's going to be less exciting than anything you've come up with in the 10 seconds since you watched the last episode, and no one in the script editing department is going to go, Russell, have you thought this through? poor old Helen Rayner. All the talent of a wet blanket. But, you know, lovely woman, I'm sure. But, yes, I mean, they flagged it in a couple of episodes earlier. So you knew it was coming, but you were hoping for better. And it's not bad. But looking back on it, it's way better than anything he manages later on. So, woo.
Okay. So then hit or miss ultimately, I guess, is the big question.
I think a moderate hit, just about.
All right.
I
mean, 51% is still a hit, so we'll take it.
Yeah, exactly. I wouldn't get out of bed for it, but at the same time,
fair enough. Yeah, DK, I don't know why, but I'm going to come to you next, DK, for your thoughts on this one.
I kind of like this one. It had Joe Joyner in it, so yeah, that's good.
Oh yeah,
not too bad. It's as Jill mentioned, it's hitting that reset button, but I think it did it in a much better way than he did in later seasons. I'm specifically thinking of the one with, oh good grief, I forgot the name. Secretary.
Donna.
You're thinking of Journey's End, yeah.
Journey's End, terrible. That was absolutely terrible. But so, you know, in comparison, this one is Shakespeare. But it's all right. It was very nice seeing the visual for next week and seeing all the missiles flying from the Dalek ship, seeing the TARDIS spinning round on its way. Yeah, I kind of enjoyed it. I like the little speech from Eccleston saying, yeah.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
I'm going to stop you. I love the whole emotional thing about the hologram, him telling Rose to just leave it on a street corner somewhere. It had its moments. It wasn't the best that Who's ever put out, but I think it was a suitable conclusion to that that first series. I think it gave kind of fans sort of what they wanted and set the stakes for new fans going forward. So I think it was successful. It's, as I say, not perfect, but it's definitely hit from me.
Okay. Before I give my thoughts, Toby, what are your thoughts on this two-part finale?
Well, the problem with Russell's two-part finale is not necessarily that the way they end, is that with each upcoming finale, he just thinks he gets more and more clever, thinks he's more and more the genius of the world.
Ah, no, come on, that's definitely a Moffat problem.
Yeah,
not
that is Moffat.
I mean, that is literally season four series 14 where everything is a mystery that exists.
Yeah, but his solution to every mystery is it didn't matter. That's not being clever. That's just not giving a shit.
Yeah, he really, it's not his bag. He really doesn't give a shit about the ending, which is fine.
I feel like in series 14, Russell thought he was really cool with that. Not clever in the sense of everything is connected, but clever in the sense of, oh, it doesn't matter. And that's so clever of me that it doesn't matter.
What you mean. There's a kind of pomposity there, but that's not what we're discussing anyway. Bad Wolf Parting of the Ways. What did you feel about that?
So I think this one is the most straight up. Okay, yeah. It's whatever. Like I set it up, I'm not going to do anything with it. Deal with it. It gets so much worse in later seasons.
Yeah,
especially series 14. I think this is the most honest. Yeah, I'm not going to give a crap. Deal with it.
Yeah,
and I can respect that on that level because I know I can expect that. See, okay, this is what you're doing. This is your style, and you're not going to pretend otherwise. So I think it works here. So it's a hit.
Okay, I kind of wish I put this down as a full review, but I haven't for this season. But I really like it. Actually, I think it's one of the better finales of the new Who show.
Yeah, that's not impressive, though, is it?
Well, I mean, I like Doctor Who.
Doctor Who, but it's
I'm a very rare Doctor Who fan that enjoys the show, right?
Yeah. What?
You're not a Doctor Who fan if you don't. I mean,
Toby's now just quit out because this was not what he signed up for.
No, that's...
I thought we're hating the show here.
Yeah, of course we do. We're normal Doctor Who fans. There's one aberration. It's because he didn't join when he was 7. That's the problem with him. He's just... He came in as an already adult, and he thinks that it's normal to like shit.
Yeah, I really liked it. I think there was enough setup for what happens in Bad Wolf Parting of the Ways. I will say I don't particularly like Bad Wolf as the setup because it just feels so disconnected. Dated. And I was just going to say it's aged dated, terribly just because it's, you know, a bunch of TV shows that were popular at the time. But again, that's Russell T. Davies. He loves his pop culture. He chucks in, you know, Anne Whittacombe and McFly to talk about the Master and whatever. So you kind of have to forgive it. But if we're talking about it as an overall thing, I really like the conclusion. And because it was the first time there'd been a big Deus Ex Machina, like, the entire Dalek fleet wiped out in a blink of an eye. Don't worry about it. It didn't seem as egregious because it was the first time. And it was like, all right, okay. And clever or not, it was, you know, it was explained a couple of episodes ago and it made sense and it tied into the whole Bad Wolf thing. And I was fine with it. And, you know, it's an episode in which you get a cool Dr. Dalek series of face-offs. You get some real epic stakes, so it seems. And then you get a regeneration at the end of it, which I've always really liked. So, so I would say hit as well. I don't know why I'm being so defensive. We all said hit. So,
we've all agreed that it's not shit. It's just... Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe that's we should consider relabeling the podcast. Not shit or miss.
Yeah, exactly. That seems fair.
I mean, the game show stuff is actually fun. I think. I mean, it's stupid, but it's a stupid shit. I'm here.
If it was its own episode, it would have been fine. But I think making it the first half.
Yeah. Okay. I get that.
Kind of like.
I get what? These are the stupid ideas I'm here for on this show.
Okay, I mean, that's cool, fair enough, yeah.
But I mean, the whole, as I said, the thing that really struck me was that the Daleks were being made out of humans, and they'd set it up. We're going to go talk about Dalek in a minute.
Jill.
Exactly, I know, but they hate themselves in a really existential way. I mean, they're not even themselves. It's and surely, if Rose's DNA causes, and we're going back to this, I appreciate, but if Rose's DNA causes them to have this real existential angst that causes them to commit suicide, how come they're all fine in Big Bad Wolf? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense at all.
I don't
because every contestant on Big Bad Wolf is dead inside.
Ah, that's a good reason. Yep.
To go on TV, you have to already be a sociopath. So, you know,
that's fine. Yeah. Okay. Okay, yeah, no, I hadn't thought that through. You're quite right. How foolish of me. I mean, I've been blind these 20 years, and now I can see at last.
The second thing on the list is just apropos of absolutely nothing. It has nothing to do with this theme, but, you know, I like an odd random thing every now and then. So hit or miss for the 12th Doctor's TARDIS. And Toby, I'm going to come to you first on this one just to mix it up. And there's a nice picture for you if you need a refresher. There we go. Toby,
thank you. I was just typing on Google.
I could hear you typing the Google search. Yeah. Don't worry, I have
one with this stuff. I don't remember anything ever. I mean, I don't think there's any TARDIS I actually dislike. So
yeah,
okay.
I'm just gonna say it because it's a TARDIS and the TARDIS is always a hit. Always, okay. It's always is, will be.
Is there anything that stands out in this one for you, for argument's sake, or not particularly?
I mean, I like the lightning.
The lightning? Oh, the lighting. You mean
lighting? Sorry, light.
Lighting. I really thought I'd missed something. I was like, is there a lightning bolt? Got you. Yeah, the lighting's good. Good, good. It's a good thing to pick.
Also, love the font, the Gallifreyan font.
Yes, that's one of the things I love. The fact that the ceiling has these Gallifreyan symbols in like a rotating thing. Very cool. DK, over to you.
I kind of like it, but it's a bit too cavernous. It feels a bit too much like a set. And I don't know. I remember when the new adventures first started, someone put up an illustration of what they envisaged the TARDIS to look like. And it looked like, you know, Heathrow Airport kind of thing. I've never been a big fan of huge console rooms. You know, growing up with Dave Davison, you know, there can be a little too much girth. It's it's at least better than the 11th Doctor's, which was just
some which one of, he had two
the first one where it looked like someone had just vomited shit all over the screen. This one I can appreciate. It's, you know, it's kind of got a little, it has that McGann vibe, but it's a bit too much. I like my console rooms kind of simple, so it's a hit, but it just gets over the line.
Okay, so another 51% hit. So yeah, Gillian, what about you? Strong feelings one way or the other towards the TARDIS?
I do love all console rooms; they're all lovely. Okay. I mean, my knowledge of the new Who console room is that it's virtually impossible to record sound in them because of the ridiculous pump they have to bring the thing going up and down. Just get someone underneath it and push it, guys. It was good enough for the old days. It's good enough for now. Yep, they had to ADR any scene that's in the TARDIS.
That sucks.
Which does suck, especially.
Yeah, that kind of kills the magic a bit.
Yeah. It's it's lovely. I do love all. As I said, all the TARDISes have all been wonderful, and this is I do like this one. It's got an internal door, which is always a bonus because that was the thing that you noticed in the first few designs, that they never had an internal door, and it always sort of confused me. But I agree with DK that it is a little large, but that's possibly just nostalgia talking. It's also my views on Epic Who. Stop it. Small. That's what I like.
I mean, I get where you're coming from with that in terms of the nostalgia factor. Even though I wasn't like, you know, I wasn't around live, but I do kind of have an appreciation for the old ones. But I do love this one. I have to say, I think this might be my favorite out of all of them because I in my head the Doctor is, you know, getting lost in this massive, much bigger on the inside type space, and he's the academic, so I love the idea of like books and bookshelves all over the walls, you know, which you just don't have in a lot of these other ones, and so that there's a kind of practicality to that as well. And the console, I think, just looks nice, you know. As I said, I love the little Gallifreyan and whatever you call it on script on like little turny things on the ceiling, which I don't know what purpose they have. I'm not that geeky, but it looks cool. And yeah, the lighting, it's nice and moody. I think it gives you that kind of study or library type vibe that I would associate, especially with the 12th Doctor. So I really like it. Like I said, I can't think of one that I prefer. Hey, that's, I think, four hits again. So
Wow,
we're doing quite well. So the next thing on the list ties in a little bit to the episode we're going to discuss, among many other things, and also does obviously link to the Daleks. Had trouble finding a pictorial representation of this, but you'll know what I mean. Hit or miss for the Last Great Time War. And Gillian, I'm going to come to you first. I have no idea why, I just decided.
Oh.
So, there you go.
the last great Time War, implying that there were a lot of other Time Wars, which is interesting.
There are a lot probably of smaller only... Time Wars, you know, you, exactly. you don't know.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, it's the last great one, so there's been several great ones. There's been some really crap ones, and yeah, that one was a bit mediocre. But yeah,
I mean, we did call World War One the war to end all wars, which it clearly wasn't. So let's not get hung up on naming conventions here.
Yeah, well, I feel I should. I mean, you know, there might be another one. As a concept, it was there to, you know, mean that continuity didn't sort of happen straight away. I understand why it got used, and I don't dislike it as a concept. Not sure it works perfectly, but then what does? So yeah, I like it. I enjoyed it. Give it a hit. Definite hit.
Okay, part of the reason of doing it in here was kind of to kill two birds with one stone, so it means we haven't got to discuss it, because it's a big part of Dalek when we first find out about, you know, the Doctor was the one that pulled the trigger and destroyed both races, and there's supposedly no survivors, but Daleks are always going to kick about and whatever. So yeah, I kind of was curious how you thought in general about, like, how that plot, what it does for the lore of the show. Do you like that it freed up, you know, not having the Doctor go back to Gallifrey every now and then or whatever? Or,
well, I think it gave Russell a clean break, didn't it? And I can understand why you'd do that. But I think bringing it to a conclusion seems to be, because it doesn't seem to be concluded even today. Seems to be massively problematic. I think they should have gone for something much simpler. But that's, I don't know how you could. I've not thought it through enough to really come up with a decent solution anyway.
I personally think the issue is that the less you see of it, the better it is. It's better as this kind of unseen, like in Dalek, when you get the hints of, like, I made it happen, the Time Lords got caught up in it, the whole Dalek race was gone. Like, we don't need to then start seeing it in depth.
No.
And I think, okay, Day of the Doctor, I think, gets away with it because I like that story. But I think the fact that we've got, like, we've got like 18 four-disc box sets of Big Finish dealing with the events of the Time War at this point, it's like, no. It was supposed to be a mystery. We're not meant to examine every inch of it, you know, in audio format.
I do enjoy those, which is even worse. Really? I'm afraid so. I quite like that sort of shit. But
okay, fair enough. No, it's just, to me, I would have preferred it to be a mystery, and it never seems to reveal anything that doesn't just, you know, detract a little bit from some of the...
Well, like, it's much like the Doctor's personality itself, isn't it? I mean, the more you know about the Doctor, the less you find him anything other than slappable.
Well, you say that, but then when people get a little bit of mystery added with the whole Timeless Child thing, they kick right off. Because they like knowing everything about their characters, apparently. Time War, yeah. Because for me, it works better as a bit of a mystery, but I still like what they did, and I love the lore, kind of the way it works, what it does for the Doctor and the Daleks in the new series. And even though I do like the Gallifreyans and the Time Lords, so I don't think it would be nice to never see them again, even though it seems like that's where we're kind of constantly heading. But anyway, Toby, over to you for this one.
I don't mind it as a concept. I don't mind it until Day of the Doctor. And that's the point where we should have just collectively said, okay, we're done with that. You can mention that, whatever, but like, let's not really do anything with it. And then it keeps on dragging on, and Gallifrey getting come back and destroyed and come back and destroyed. And what are we doing here?
That's the issue.
I don't think that's a Time War thing, though. It's like, that's just Chibnall deciding,
it's kind of related to that, though, isn't it?
I mean, is
it? Yeah. I mean, Gallifrey's destroyed because of the Time War, so to bring it back, you need to have that. And decide on one. Like, have it exist or not exist, I don't care. But like, decide one and leave it untouched for 50 years.
It feels to me a little bit like a kind of, it's the kind of child that's being abused by parents that are trying, they don't know what they want from it. So it's kind of like Russell T, is like, no, I don't want Gallifrey. It was destroyed in the Time War, blah, blah. Then Moffat comes along, which I prefer, and was like, you can't really do that. So let's have it be the Doctor thought that, but Gallifrey was saved all along. And you have Chibnall that's like, I don't want it, so we're going to just destroy it all again. And it's like, make your bloody mind up. I don't mind either way, but just pick one. So,
RTD, bring back Gallifrey.
He doesn't want it. That's the thing. He seems content to be like, well,
now then.
We've restored his status quo. If it's destroyed, we don't have to explain which of the two times mattered the most. So we'll just say it's not there anymore. And all right, good. I guess, you know.
Yeah, which is fine within the context of there's still some other Time Lords out there, I presume.
We can hope, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, that got really weird. DK, your thoughts on the Great Time War?
I liked it in series one. I liked it in series two, but then they just kind of started drawing it out.
That's
a
what
lot.
I said.
Yeah, no, it's...
Well, that's because you were right.
Yeah.
don't knock it. I know it's rare, but...
I'm going to say, I know it's hard to believe, but we are going to agree sometimes, Mike.
Yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah, I know. Mike's now jacking the podcast in. Day of the Doctor was fun. I could have done without the whole... As great as it is to have an actor of John Hurt's stature in, I could have done without the whole War Doctor thing. It was just too convoluted. I kind of like, you know, the Gallifrey Falls No More shtick. But then, you know, you're back to square one. I like how it was dealt with, or not dealt with, in series one of New Who, where this immense tragedy happened, you know, and Eccleston saying, you know, I watched it happen, I made it happen. It gives him that edge, and I like that. But you could have just kind of stuck to that and moved on eventually. As Toby says, they're continually bringing it back, then destroying it again. It's a lot of diminishing returns.
Again, I don't really blame the Time War plot for that. I think Moffat, basically, his intention in the 50th was like, it's the 50th anniversary, so we're going to bring it back, we'll reveal that it isn't this kind of mass killer, and we'll be fine with it. And then, like I said, it just felt weird that Chris Chibnall was like, and now it's been wiped out again by the Cybermen or something.
Yeah.
It's just kind of like, what are we doing?
But even under Moffat's tenure, you know, when you had the whole Rassilon come back and all that kind of stuff, for fans who like been with, you know, external media, they'd already seen that. And a lot of people that weren't fans are just like,
Nobody gives a shit
who Rassilon is. It just...
Well, to be fair, Russell T Davies brought him back as Timothy Dalton first. It wasn't Moffat. Well,
yeah, no, but everyone's trying to forget those specials, aren't they?
I honestly, until Mike had just brought it up.
I like them.
I don't know. There comes a point where it is a bit self-referential. And at that point, if you're trying to be self-referential after like three or four series, it's not going to work. It doesn't have that clout. It just became law of diminishing returns. And as it stands, especially in the episode that we're discussing, especially in that first series, I think it's a surefire hit. It adds an angle to the mythos that hasn't been there before. And it's a really interesting take. And just to have that background, you don't necessarily have to keep referring to it, but it's there. There's a big tragedy and it plays into everything that's happening. And I love that aspect of it. It's when they started bringing it up all the time, you just thought, okay, now it's getting a bit too much. And then when Moffat did the whole retcon, not a big fan.
Oh, I love that. I'm fine with that.
As I say, it was all right as a bit of a fun thing, but I just thought it was a bit convoluted. But again, you know, it's an anniversary. You can kind of forgive it, you know. Just leave it at that. And Chibnall's here. It's gone again.
And I mean, I don't mind most of the Chibnall era, just so people don't get the impression that I'm like, everything he did was terrible, but I just don't get the point of destroying Gallifrey. Just leave it be. Yeah. it's lost in another dimension or whatever. Just leave it. You don't have to say it, and it's all being destroyed again. You know?
Well, you could, you could have quite simply left it on that. You know, I'm going to go home, but the long way around. You don't know where it is.
And
there's
no need
to bring it back, only for it to just go, I brought it back just to wipe it out again. It's pointless.
Yeah. Yeah, and I feel like a lot of it is that Russell T Davies just really loves the phrase "Last of the Time Lords." He just loves to drop that into every bit of description. It's just at this point, I'm so sick of hearing that shit.
Like in a new trailer?
No, you're not. No, you're not. The Master's out there. We all know it.
Because at this point, you'd had, you know, in external media, you had Time Wars before. Yeah. So for fans, you're just saying, oh, okay, that kind of works. For non-fans who aren't into that kind of stuff, it's just an intriguing concept. But the thing to make a concept not intriguing is to continually double down on it.
Well, and explain it full stop. I mean, it is like explaining too much of the Doctor. You don't need it. As soon as you start explaining something, it becomes boring.
Absolutely. Although I have to say, I do really like, and I know it's not official, kind of like canon or whatever, but I do like the idea that the Time War kind of encompasses all every Dalek classic story, like after Genesis of the Daleks. Like that was the first volley in the Time War, because it's the Time Lords going, let's use time travel to go back and prevent them from ever existing. And the Daleks were rightfully pissed off and like, hang on, it's not a bit unfair, isn't it?
See, the thing is, in the book, she had had the whole faction paradox thing, which I'm not even going to get into because that's so convoluted. It makes this look like A to B. But then you had another time war where Gallifrey was destroyed by the Daleks, and then they kind of thought, oh, we better bring it back because there's going to be a new series coming. So the new series turned up, and there it goes again. So you're kind of like on the fourth destruction of Gallifrey by this point.
Fair enough. But it's
like being a member of the X-Men and dying. It's never going to stay.
Or just being anyone in comics who isn't Uncle Ben. Anyway, but no, I think I'm going to say hit, and I think we've all basically said hit for that. But you know, maybe don't overdo it, or maybe step away from it.
Walk away.
Yeah. But I have to say, in the episode we're reviewing, really good, really effective, and I'd say a hit there in particular. Cool. So the next thing on the list is just a very random thing, and again, sorry, the pictorial representation is just vague because it has to be. Hit or miss for UNIT. Whether that's United Nations Intelligence Task Force or Unified Intelligence, I don't really care. Hit or miss generally. Toby, I'll come to you first on that one.
I don't mind UNIT. Not every story with UNIT is good, but...
No, but UNIT, I'm talking about as a general concept, not like every story.
UNIT was never the problem in that. No, I like UNIT.
We're soon going to find out in Beyond the Bloody Sea or whatever it's bloody called.
Maybe at some point we can move on from Kate. I love Kate, but it's been a lot of years, and I think we've done everything soon that is to be done with her. So maybe at some point move on.
It's a legacy character. You're never going to write her out. She's the Brigadier's daughter.
I suppose the only thing you can do with her is put her in a three-way relationship, which would be as outrageous as Russell has ever managed to be. I mean, because there's a lot of, from what I can gather, there's a lot of lesbians who really want to ship Kate. I don't understand why, but then I've never liked blondes. And of course, she's holding hands with a young gentleman in the last episode. So
yeah, I think that was the implication was that her and her underling were in a relationship, which UNIT has no particular airdrop.
Yeah, I mean,
they are hiring children, so who gives it?
Yeah, they're really the work ethic is quite. They really are
the worst company ever.
Jesus.
Like, I get you save the world and I'm appreciative, but dear God, have some better HR unit.
Yes. How did you get this job? Oh, shag the commander. Oh, right. Yeah, me too. Yeah. It's a lovely concept to have a little group that the Doctor can go and play with, but they are a little authoritarian, I suppose, for Doctor Who as a concept.
I think that kind of works, though, because you kind of have to be to push against the Doctor, who's very the opposite of that, you know? So, And I kind of like it shouldn't work, but it does, the idea that he has this, like, his best friend is the Brigadier, who's, like, the most stiff upper lip authoritarian, kill them all, you know, kind of guy. And then you got this ultra-liberal, everybody deserves to live man, Doctor, and they're like, somehow they're best friends.
Opposites attract, as they say.
Where did we land on UNIT as a
whole? Oh, hit, definitely hit, yeah.
So hit from Gillian. Toby, what did you say?
Hit, apparently, literally.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. TK, we didn't get your thoughts on UNIT.
I preferred it when it was just like three or four guys in an office. it strikes me a bit too much these days of it trying to be the Avengers initiative. And I get that it's trying to, you know, look impressive and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, it's just a bunch of inepts in an office. And I have no idea how they would run this thing. So It's a hit. It's a hit, but more for the old style unit rather than the skyscraper full of people. Let's hire every single one of the Doctor's old companions.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I don't love the new version as much. A unit for me will always be the kind of Third Doctor era, the peculiarly British. You know, we've got an army barracks with about 8 blokes in it,
and a big sign out the front saying "Secret
Unit, Secret Base." Don't ask. You know, whatever. Yeah,
look over there. Lovely ducks.
Yeah, oh. we're so secret. We're going to go to the United Nations in front of everybody and ask about this alien invasion. Just shush. But no, I mean, it was of its time. But I loved what they did. Even though I know the producers at the time didn't love the whole grounding the Doctor on Earth thing, I really like that era. I think it works. And having UNIT there, I think, is the only reason that it works. Because without them, what would that era look like? You know, it would be a mess.
You are completely correct in that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we forget how good a producer Barry Letts is sometimes, because he gets given some really weird cards and then actually deals very well with them.
Yeah. But I find myself disagreeing, because as I'm watching the features on the Blu-rays and stuff, and Terrence Dix is like, oh, I hated the idea of UNIT and him being grounded. And as soon as we could get him off planet, we did. And it was much better. And I was like, have you seen your stories? Are you really telling me Colony in Space is a better story than any of the ground-based UNIT stories? Because it's not.
poor old Colony in Space.
Oh, it's terrible. The mutants, it's also awful. The Peloton stories, not great.
Oh, love Curse. Again, it was part of the Five Faces or Monsters of Doctor Who. I cannot remember which one. I have to look it up. I wish. So it's the first Third Doctor story I ever saw.
That was definitely Monsters, I believe.
That was
Monsters. Five Faces was three Doctors.
Oh, in that case, it's the second Doctor story I ever saw.
Ironically, the first one I saw and I really liked it actually does not feature UNIT. It's Carnival of Monsters. So I'm kind of proving myself wrong here.
Oh my God, no, you're right. That was Five
Carnival
Faces.
Of Monsters, yeah. That's
Carnival of Monsters, yeah.
Yeah.
That
wasn't when I saw it. I'm not that old. So we're going to jump into the main bulk of the episode then, which will be a big episode review. And we've already explained what that's going to be. It's going to be the 2005 episode Dalek. So we are going to, first of all, activate the time-space visualizer and go behind the scenes. And DK, that is your job. So over to you.
That meant that you could just tune in and see any event in history.
Yes, that's exactly what this is.
No, Dr. York, kidding.
Okay.
Even though the episode is highly acclaimed, it is today the only episode that Rob Shearman has written for the series. It was based on his original Big Finish audio adventure episode, Jubilee, in which the Sixth Doctor and his companion, Evelyn Smythe, stumble upon an English empire who are holding a Dalek prisoner and torturing it. The Daleks almost didn't appear in this episode due to a dispute with the estate of Terry Nation. Shearman had to write a second version of the script because it was not initially known if the new series could obtain said rights to use the Daleks from Nation's estate. So he had to create an alternate alien race that would have been used had the Daleks not been available. The alternate monster was a spheroid creature akin to a sadistic child, which was actually a mutated version of humanity from the end of time. Although this alternate concept was shelved, it would later be used for the Toclophane in the Series 3 finale, Sound of Drums, and Last of the Time Lords. It's the first televised Dalek story not to feature their creator Davros or use the title Such and Such of the Daleks since Death of the Daleks Part 1 in 1974. Henry Van Staten was originally named Will Fences in a joking allusion to Bill Gates. This was later changed to Mr. Duquesne, but Russell T. Davis was concerned that this was too difficult to pronounce. It's revealed in this episode that time travel changes human DNA, something that will later become an important plot point during the 11th Doctor's tenure. The episode also re-establishes a point of Time Lord physiology, that they have two hearts. This was originally revealed, obviously, in Spearhead from Space back in 1970. And the Cyberman head displayed in Van Staten's museum is quite clearly of the model featured in Revenge of the Cybermen, as distinguished by the corrugated handlebars and the gun atop their helmet. And, behind and to the left of the TARDIS is a display holding an alien egg from the Alien movie series. So yeah, I have that for the moment, but there will be the odd.
Oh, I've got lots as well when we get to the other sections.
Yeah.
I foolishly opened Doctor Who: The Inside Story and then found reams upon reams about this episode. So apologies. I'm going to try not to bog it down, but we'll see what I can get to.
I've got a fair bit when we get to writing. So,
well, yes, indeed. Cool. Well, I'll let you go first, and then anything we've already covered, I'll ignore. So, I don't want to quickly add to your BTS that obviously you said this was based on the audio play Jubilee, and that Jubilee will be released as a book, newly novelized by Rob Shearman in October this year, along with an adaptation of another of his fan favorite audio stories, The Chimes of Midnight. And I can't wait. I shall be ordering both and getting them when they come out. So, yeah. So before we get into the like individual sections where we break it down with like writing, plot, directing, visual effects, you know, various other things, acting, etc., etc., I'm going to go around and ask what I always ask, which is to, if you can remember your first experiences of this story, and without too much of a heavy spoiler, what you thought of it initially and what you kind of came away with when you first watched, I'm guessing in 2005. And yeah, Jill, I'll come to you first. Why not, Jillian?
I really love this story. Once again, Russell really does bring out the best in other writers. He just somehow manages to get other writers to up their game that little bit. It's a wonderful story. Does a lot of interesting things. Although I have to say, I was slightly worried about Rob Shearman's mental health at the end, for reasons that are obvious when you watch.
I mean. Story. Have you read the Target novelization? Because you'd be even more worried about some of the stuff in there.
Exactly. I am worried about Rob's mental health generally. Yes.
Yeah. He's a bit of a weird egg, bless him, but he writes really well, so we'll forgive him.
we'll wander down to the National Theatre, where he hangs out quite often, and find out later on, I'm sure.
Never met the guy, but I love his work. I love The Chimes of Midnight, especially. It's so good. But that's not what we're talking about. So it's everything. No. So initially you were kind of enthused by it.
Yeah, very loved it.
Was it the first kind of Series 1, if you want to call it that, whatever? I hate this numbering thing. Series 1 episode that you really kind of responded to, or had you liked enough of things to go?
Yeah, it probably was the first that I'd gone wow to. Yes. I hadn't disliked the Unquiet Dead, but I'd loathed Rose. And Aliens of London and whatever the follow-up, World War III. Thank you, Brian. They're not good, are they? They're really not good. End of the World. Oh yeah, no, that was fun throwaway fun. That's fine. Okay. That was lovely. But yeah, three out of the previous five had been...
There'd been some good stuff, but there'd been some farting aliens. Let's leave it.
That's where we're going with that one, yes.
Yeah, fair enough. Toby, what about you? Can you remember your initial thoughts on this episode? Did you watch it in 2005? You probably weren't born then because you're too young.
I was born in... Excuse me.
Oh, sorry, you were like, what, three or something?
Well, yes, but that's neither here nor there. Let's not talk about that.
Well, I, so I when had was three, the first time you watched it? Sorry. And in my age at the time, does that count?
But no, Toby. So when was the first time you saw it? I'm guessing it probably wasn't when you were 3 years old. Probably would have been a bit intense for you at that age.
No, I don't know the year. Somewhere between series 9 and series 10, because series 10 was the first I watched live.
Okay.
The air date for series 9 here was like a year later from when it actually aired, so it was...
Ah.
Yeah.
Damn. So it was somewhere between 2014 and 2016.
We don't need to get bogged down in the exact... Around a decade after the initial day.
It was a Tuesday around...
It's actually 16 minutes past 7 when I realised I was watching Dalek for the first time.
I mean, I was sick, so... If I cram into my doctor's notes, I could find the date, probably. But I'm not going
we don't
to do
need
that.
An exact date, do we? We just need your thoughts.
My first thoughts is, I don't remember.
After all of that?
Yep.
I don't remember what I thought. All right. I like this episode, but I don't remember what I thought.
So I presume you have thoughts on the episode now.
What episode?
That's not funny.
Okay. Anyway. Anyone know the number for a doctor near Toby? I feel so we may need to send someone there. This doesn't sound
it's just across the street. Just literally a 10-second walk.
Yes, but he has probably to come to best. You.
Does he have a restraining order?
Exactly, yeah. He has to do the paperwork with you there, you see.
I can't really remember your first time, but obviously you'll have watched it since and you've developed some thoughts on it, which we'll get in time, don't we, I suppose.
I mean, I watched it 3 hours ago, if that counts.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's fresh in your mind. We've all, well, I know myself and DK have rewatched it for the podcast, so it's quite fresh and recent. So, yeah, so DK, ignoring that recent watch, can you remember the first time that you saw it and what your thoughts were?
Yeah, it was on broadcast. Yeah, I enjoyed it. It's... I'd kind of got into the new Who vibe at that point. I mean, I even tolerated things like Aliens of London. I mean, it's not great, let's be honest. But, yeah, I think from End of the World, which, as Jill said, it was kind of a fun one, and it kind of gave you a glimpse into the kind of who-ness of it all. But I think this one was the first one to where everybody kind of sat up and went, oh, okay, this is good. This is actually good. Up until that point, Who fans were kind of celebrating to an extent that the show was back.
Yeah.
But now the show was back and it was actually quite good. And everything that had been leveled against the design of the Daleks and stuff like that was kind of being addressed. Which, you know, yes. I'll get into, but yeah, it kind of brought I'm not going to say a Dalek mania, but it kind of got, it brought that vibe along again. It resuscitated it. And I do remember, I mean, back at that point, I would watch an episode and then, and Jill will be familiar with this, I would get straight onto Outpost Gallifrey afterwards to see what everyone else's. What everyone else's opinion was of this one, and across the board, people were kind of loving this, which they hadn't done for previous episodes. So yeah, it was a good one.
Cool.
So this was the first and last time Whovians actually enjoyed the show.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we obviously, when we say we love the show, we went. It wasn't complete shit. I mean, that's yeah. That's a sign that you're utterly in love with something that you just went, it's all right, isn't it?
There'll always be something. There'll always be something that people will pick up. But I think this was the first one in that series where people weren't just grinning and smiling for the public and tolerating it, while at the same time thinking, oh, no. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Yeah, no, I don't really have much to add. I did see it on broadcast and I really loved it. I thought it was the first time that it had embraced the kind of geeky side of the show and the science fiction side and the lore and everything, and I was here for that. And like you said, it was kind of cool to see a big middle finger to all the people that are like, no, Dalek, sink plunger, I can't go upstairs. Oh, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, so that was quite handy. Yeah.
But,
so,
but you had an army of Whovians at that point going, actually, and pointing at, you know, Remembrance of the Daleks. And
I know.
Like, yeah, get away, nerd. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, nobody watched that. Go away. So, yeah,
it's
anyway.
It's rather good.
It's always nice watching Michael Sheard knee Sophie Aldred in the groin.
Yes, fair point.
You have a very weird fetish, my friend, but anyway. So, moving along. I'm going to move to the writing and the plot then. And again, DK, you have a lot, and so have I. So we'll start with you. What have you got on the writing and the plot?
Yeah, Shearman, he was coming off a not entirely pleasant experience from 2002's Born and Bred, and he decided that he wasn't going to do TV besides his own concept. His agent thus dutifully turned down the offer to write for the series, and Shearman was pretty quick to get that straightened out. But T. Davis wished for the episode to be emotional rather than relying on people running down corridors. Yeah, Shearman expressed a desire to take all of those things people find funny about the Daleks and turn them into something people would find memorable. To accomplish this, before writing the script, he asked his then-girlfriend what she thought were the silliest things about the Daleks. He then took the responses he got, that they couldn't go upstairs, that they had that silly plunger, they couldn't see anything behind them, that bullets could damage them, etc., and had the characters actively invoke them in the story. He then had the Dalek completely subvert the weaknesses the audience would expect and even use them to kill said characters horribly. He found the difficulty in adapting Jubilee to television hinged on part on the fact that Jubilee was based around the problem of overfamiliarity with the Daleks, whereas Dalek is about introducing them fresh. Shearman took this to extremes, attempting to get through the entire episode without naming the Daleks and wanting to call it the Creature of Lies. Russell T. Davis was unimpressed with this approach. Shearman's earlier drafts, also like Jubilee, focused extensively on the supporting cast, taking much of the episode for the Dalek to be released. Davis, again, was unimpressed. Robert Shearman, he viciously resisted notes from the BBC, insisting that the Dalek be humanized in the final scene, proclaiming Rose to be its friend. Shearman was adamant that the Dalek remain a fascist, and wanted the focus to be on how it would rather die than be like the humans. And over the 14 drafts of the script, many things changed. Originally, there was more of a focus on the Van Stattens as a family, with Van Statten having a wife and Adam being their son. The entire supposed motivation for torturing the Dalek was to be able to get it to say happy birthday to Van Statten. The Dalek was to be so disgusted for being subjected to extreme torture for the most banal of reasons that it wouldn't even dignify them with extermination, instead turning away with utter contempt. Other drafts featured Van Statten mutating into a Dalek. The only item to remain in every single draft of the script was the hairdryer joke.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what I've got, mate. So over to you.
Yeah, I've got a couple of things, but they're quite long. But it's mainly quotes from Robert Shearman, like I said, from the Doctor Who Inside Story book. So first of all, and again, this is Shearman talking. He said, "I was trying to write a story for an audience who only knew about Daleks because their parents had mentioned them. My early drafts had some nice, funny ideas, but were a bit too slow. It took ages for the Dalek to get out of the cell. The Dalek gun was sentient and broke through glass in the museum cases, exterminating people." Would have kind of loved to see that. I took a long time on that, and Russell and Julie Gardner's very politely worded comments were about really needing to have things happen more quickly. I was trying too hard to make all the human characters stand out, and they would remind me quite rightly that what people wanted to see was the Dalek. I was trying to be a bit too clever too often. I was keen to make the Dalek into a communicable character, and Russell urged me to go further with that. He looked at the scene when the Doctor first meets the Dalek, which was closely based on the audio version, full of traditional Doctor Who stuff about the Doctor never being cruel or cowardly. Russell pointed out how boring that is. He suggested we just have the Doctor go mad. Once he had given me that freedom to explore the Doctor and the Dalek, those scenes became an absolute blast to write. At one point, Russell and I had a very long chat, emails back and forth at about 3 a.m. He wasn't speaking at my boss as my boss, which was lovely. He was speaking to me as a fellow writer, sympathizing and suggesting ways of approaching it. I loved that. You don't normally get that sort of approach. I think that feeds into what Jill was saying about Russell bringing the best out of others more than himself. But yeah. The other thing I found, just a little note about, was that Rob Shearman says, the biggest problem for me was Rose fancying Adam, which I found very hard to do. Ouch. And Russell made it work by making it clear that what Rose fancied in Adam was a doctorish element, which is why Adam says fantastic, which is such a great shorthand, which I didn't even notice until this time around. I'll be honest, it was very blinking, you'll miss it. So, yeah. Yeah, the only other thing I wanted to bring up, which is a note of mine before we get into the actual kind of things. I've mentioned that I did read most of the Target novelization of Dalek before coming into this review. And what stands out to me, one of the biggest things, is that there's no Cyberman head in the Van Statten's museum, which one of the things I love about this episode is that it does that for kind of like geeky fan service. And it makes me wonder if it was something like the production team just chucked in a prop that they happened to have handy because they didn't have enough to fill the cases. And I do kind of wonder what would have happened with the whole kind of like, I love that they reference this back in Rise of the Cybermen with Rose saying, oh, I saw Cybermen before, the head with the handles in Van Staten Museum. It's like, would we have just not got that call back at all if that hadn't been there? So,
from anyway. What I gather, they exclusively wanted to fill the museum with creatures from the new series. But obviously by that point, there wasn't really a great many creatures in the new series.
I mean, they have the Slitheen arm, but yeah, obviously there's not much else.
So they had to improvise, which I presume is why we ended up with that. But I think it's a beautiful little moment.
Oh, I love that moment, absolutely, even though, as I said, it doesn't make a lot of sense for it to be a revenge era Cyberman, because really it's supposed to be the ones from the invasion, from the English sewers. but you know, we care too much about some of these minute details sometimes.
But anyway. Roll out the Joel gif. It's been a while.
It's just a show, relax. So, yeah, writing and plot then. I'm going to open up the floor and I'll come to you first, Jill, and ask, is there anything that stands out in the plot that you wanted to kind of bring up and you wanted to discuss that you think works or doesn't work?
Not really from that point of view. I'd have to say my only real issue is the character of Adam, he's obviously supposed to be a Dr. Light, but just that he says the word fantastic, and that's literally the only thing that's even remotely doctory about him. And he's got a bit of music behind him. It's the weirdest bit of music.
Yeah, that's Murray Gold. He wants you to know what you should be feeling.
Very odd bit of music. It's a very strange musical choice, yes. No, I mean, from a plot point of view, it's plotted beautifully. There's a lot of running down corridors, which I bloody love. I've always loved a corridor run.
Cool. And so were you kind of happy with the way they reintroduced the Daleks for A New Generation? And the plot all made sense? You didn't think there was any kind of shortcuts to get it out of the cell or whatever? Or
I didn't think so. No, I mean, it all made perfect sense that... I mean, I went with Artron energy as soon as she touched the Dalek, rather than it's got funny DNA because she's travelled in time.
It's the same thing.
It's the same thing, exactly. So it all made perfect sense in my head anyway. And not that there's much in there, but...
Yeah, I get you. That's cool. So, Toby, I'll ask you this next question then, which is, obviously we all think that the handling of the Dalek was really good and that's the main focus. But do you think that the kind of secondary, if you want to call them secondary villain, of kind of Van Staten and his kind of whole thing was very effective? What did you think about that when you watched this again?
I mean, he's fine. I think he works for the story. It's not like a character that I'm excited about. But I think he works well enough in the story to exist. I mean, I like the idea of this museum. That's a cool idea. His character, it's fine. There's nothing wrong with it.
Well, it's oddly prescient, really, given the current state of the universe. But yes.
Yeah. It seems like everything I watch for a podcast, I'm watching it nowadays, like, oh, good God, we were being warned, weren't we? Oh, God.
There's a bit where the Doctor and Van Staten have a sort of a face-off and Rose goes, you could smell the testosterone in here. You're thinking, no, you two are just out-nerding each other. This isn't masculine. It's embarrassing.
Blimey, you can smell the testosterone.
Yeah, that you really can't.
Really 2005 writing.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
No. Not that bad.
That's fair enough. Yeah, no, I know what you mean, but I kind of, like you said, it's weirdly even more prescient now, the idea that a man could have the level of power and be like, who should we install as president? I own the internet, blah, blah, blah. And it's kind of, it seemed stupid at the time, but watching it now, you're like, oh, God, this is horribly plausible nowadays.
And the fact that he is such a nerd. I mean, he really is, you know, the ultimate computer programmer. Oh, look at me, I've programmed a computer and I can now take over the world. What? My dad's a computer programmer. How come he's not taking over the world?
Having said that, I think it's more like, not unlike some real world people, he thinks he's a genius and he really isn't.
Well,
but
he
happens to have thrown enough money and power at things that he's like, look, I'm the best. And in actual fact, he's just a petulant child.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, that would never happen in real life, though.
Nobody could possibly, you know, weaponize the internet for their own means.
No.
The problem I have with this, and I don't know if it's down to the writing, the direction, it's when you look at it from with a 2005 perspective, it was obviously much more advanced than Classic Who. But when you look at it now, looking back, the scenes not featuring the Dalek, it all comes across to me as a bit panto.
Oh, I just
know it doesn't.
Oh, God. Yeah, it just, I don't know, some of the human characters.
No, I couldn't disagree more with that. I think Eccleston and all of the actors.
We're back to normal now, mate.
So. No, I think I really like, is it Corey Johnson's performance as Van Staten? I think he gets across the perfect blend of like like I said, he's just, he thinks he's the most macho, most intelligent, greatest thing in the world, but he's just a sniveling kid.
Not so much him, but Bruno Langley. I mean, Bruno Langley.
I try to ignore Bruno Langley's existence in general, but in the episode particularly, you know.
And it
allegations
is weird,
aside, you know.
Because even at the time, he's presented as, this is the new companion, and we all went, no, he's not. And we were bloody right. And I have no idea why we all knew, because we did at the time. I don't remember ever thinking, oh, Bruno Langley's the new companion.
No, nobody ever did.
He's just not really there.
You were just waiting for him to have his long game moment, which they gave us in the next episode.
I don't know. I'm too familiar with TV tropes, and I was like, well, they're not going to have... In this episode, you literally have the Dalek calling out to the Doctor, like, ha-ha, it's the woman you love. And I was like, well... They can't do that this early, so they're going to have to throw a spanner in the works and be like, oh, here's someone else for Rose to fancy. And they try that multiple times. They try it with Adam, they try it with Captain Jack, and it's kind of like, it doesn't work any of those times.
No, you could kind of buy into, you could kind of buy into why she kind of fancied Captain Jack. But not just because he said the word fantastic.
That is not a term.
No, but I was fine with it. I mean, I like that. I think that scene works for me because I like the idea that it's not just that he said that. It's kind of the idea that she senses somebody that's like, you know, I want to kind of be among the stars and be the opposite of this Van Staten who just wants to catalog everything. And she kind of sees him say, you know, but it's never going to happen in our lifetime. It would be lovely to, and it would be my dream and whatever else. But
it just feels a bit, it just feels a bit, for the character Rose, it feels a bit, I don't know, regressive, because you at that point, you've been through that thing, that entire thing with Mickey. And I don't think Adam would have impressed her that much.
Oh, I think
if I'm being honest.
I mean, you've got to remember.
I think love for the Doctor in that moment.
Yeah, you've got to remember as well. She is actually ultimately still only 19 at this point. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
I mean, I appreciate that you brought it up in Hit and Miss, because she said we're not going to talk about it, but I'm going to bring it up anyway.
No, go for it.
I do like that. This is the episode that kind of most relies on what went before, and it gives the episode a kind of heavy tone that I love. Which then feeds into, you know, you'd make a good Dalek, because she's obviously so blinded by hatred. I love that angle in this. This, weirdly enough, this felt most like what I was expecting from Doctor Who when it was announced that RTD was going to be running it.
Because, certainly when they announced Eccleston was the Doctor, I was expecting more of this angry kind of... I don't mind the kind of fun-loving, jokey one, and that's kind of what won a lot of people over, the kind of, you know, that side of his Doctor, but I was certainly expecting something a lot more, like you said, close to this portrayal.
Well, when they announced it, I mean, we'd not been a few months from the that Second Coming TV series, which was RTD and Christopher Eccleston.
Didn't have an ending much there either.
It didn't, but it was much more successful than, you know, Journey's End. I was expecting that kind of tone. So when we didn't get that kind of tone, it was kind of, okay, I get it. It's, you know, they're doing it for kids. So when this one hit and, you know, it's discussing genocide and, the natural prejudice that they have for each other and the sheer amount of death, even though I'm sure she's exaggerating at the end, 200.
Yeah. I don't know, man. I was counting it along this time because I was like, this is actually a really big bloody death count this episode. It's got to be one of Doctor Who's worst, you know?
It is.
No, sorry. That's Resurrection, isn't it? It's Resurrection of the Daleks. You see 120 on-screen deaths, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying it is the worst, but I'm talking about, like, except when you're coming off a couple of weeks previously where it was like, hey, kids, look at the farting alien. Ooh, it's unzipping its head. And then you get we've just slaughtered like a bunch of people in the rain.
I think this was the most kind of like, which is ironic because it's like one of the first ones that, you know, he didn't do that and I'm Quiet Dead. But it felt the most what I was expecting when it was announced, who was announced. And I loved that, you know, they do tie into the themes. And it's completely serious the whole way through the genocide and the prejudice. And then, you know, I'd rather kill myself than be like you kind of thing. I think it's got some brilliant scripting in this. You know, this isn't
life. The scripting's great. And that's why I was going to say, I don't agree with your kind of assertion that, oh, when the Dalek's not on screen, it's kind of panto. Because I think that you get moments like,
Like I said, I don't think it's necessarily the script. I think it's the way it's directed at this point. That whole glib bullshit at the end, and I know it's tying back to the thing, you know, drop him off in San Diego. Sacramento.
Oh, that's a one-off joke.
It just feels a bit.
It's a smart-ass joke, but that's probably something RTD chucked in. It's what he does. You know, you've got to forgive it. I can deal with it because at least you have the satisfaction of like, well, the bad guy's been dealt with, which he kind of deserves at this point. You know what I mean? So it's a shorthand way of doing that. You've got 45 minutes. What else are you going to do? You know, so yeah. I'm fine with it. Disregarding that for a second, I mean, you look at the scene, as I was going to say, in the lift where Eccleston's talking to Van Staten and he says like, oh, well, the Dalek is the worst thing ever, pure evil. But you know what else? It's honest, which makes it better than you. You know, yeah. I'm just like, ouch, man, you know.
That feels kind of like the alien in Aliens, you know.
Exactly, yeah. And even later on, I think, I can't remember what scene it is, but I think it's the Doctor tells Van Staten, like, you're the farthest away from being kind of an explorer who wants to see things. You want to just drag the stars down with you and catalogue them and keep them for yourself. And, you're not any of these great things that you want to believe you are. And, yeah, it's harsh, but it's probably true and fair. So
I think I
love the way it plays in.
I know I'm jumping ahead, but I think a lot of how this episode works is Eccleston. Eccleston's portrayal in this. I mean,
I couldn't agree more, yeah.
You know, not just for his ranting, but there's that bit where, you know, he's showing him this artifact and it turns out to be that musical instrument and Van Staten messes with it, finds it cute and then tosses it to one side. And then you see the look of absolute content on the Doctor's face when he sees him do that and he's instantly gone and pegged.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a fantastic scene in the book as well. But I don't know why that stuck in my memory, but it's because it can get into the internal thoughts. So it's the way that it's like Van Staten's furious at it because he can't do it. And then he gets angry because the Doctor's like, I did so you're delicate. Then when he masters it, he's like, now I have no interest in it whatsoever and just throws it away. Like, all right, okay, I see what you're doing here.
Yeah.
Yeah, awesome. But no, I think a couple of things. First of all, I think what works about the Time War info dump, as it were, is that it isn't that. It's not given to you as a huge pile of exposition. It's kind of hinted at in little bits of dialogue. It doesn't stop and say, oh, Van Staten, there was this thing, it was the Great Time War, and I destroyed everyone, and I had a button to press, and I had to do this or that, and then it stopped the story for 20 minutes to tell you the backstory. It's like the odd line here and there, but you get enough to know exactly what, you know, the impact was and what happened, enough in your own mind, you know. You don't need to know anything other than the Doctor saying, I made it happen. You know, the Dalek race was wiped out. And then when the Dalek says, you know, well, what about the Time Lords? They're gone as well. You know, oh, but the coward survived, which is got to be the worst thing for anybody to hear. Like, ouch.
Yeah.
And the Doctor saying, you know, not by choice. So, yeah, it's all very good, very good, very well written. And the last thing I want to say before moving on, although we can still talk about the writing in the other sections, I just wanted to point out that I'll probably say this as we talk about various season one episodes, but if you're playing Spot the RTD reference, at the very start of the episode, the helicopter says it's Bad Wolf 1 is the call sign. Bad Wolf 1 descending. So that's your Bad Wolf reference for this episode, in case you missed it. We'll move to the acting next, because why not? And do you have anything on that, TK? I have a lot, but it's mostly about the Dalek people. So.
Yeah, the Doctor's interaction with the Dalek, it was originally written to be just mocking and flippant. Eccleston decided to pour in incredible amounts of rage and pain. Also, Robert Sherman, he was briefly miffed, then delighted once he realised how well it worked. Apparently, Eccleston's father was dying at the time of filming, so the fury he displays during the Dalek rant was very real. He gets so worked up at one point that he kind of like literally foams at the mouth in one scene. It wasn't planned, but Eccleston insisted on keeping it in. He apparently buttonholed Nick Briggs and rehearsed their two-way dialogue over lunch. Eccleston viewed the scene as kind of like a Holocaust survivor confronting a Nazi, and apparently he was so intense about it, it alarmed Briggs with his seriousness.
I have a couple of things on the acting, but it's about the Dalek, because I think the Dalek performance in here is fantastic, and there's obviously a couple of people involved in that, so I did want to mention some things that are mentioned in that book I referenced earlier. So first of all, let me see. Over the years, a number of talented actors and voice artists have provided the Daleks' vocals, and Nicholas Briggs is the latest in that line. He said, I wanted to make it sound like an authentic Dalek, but at the same time give it more expression. That was essential for the story. The Dalek had to work as a character, not just a speak-your-weight machine. My favourite Dalek voices were done by Peter Hawkins in the 60s, so when the tonal quality of my Dalek voice sounded nearest to his Dalek, I was happy. Okay. Barnaby Edwards, Dalek operator, had previously operated one of the beasts in the documentary 30 Years in the TARDIS in 1993. He said, operating a Dalek is a tricky business and isn't something actors get preparation for at drama school. It's cramped, dark, and airless in there. You have to strain to hear. Your vision is limited to a mesh at head height, and there are wires and batteries and projecting metal envelope-sized piece of bolts all waiting to garrote, electrocute, or impale you. Jesus. Health and safety, man. In addition to this, you have to be dressed from the neck down in black and wear a stocking on your head so that your face isn't visible through the mesh. The Dalek itself weighs about 10 stone, so add that to your own body weight, and that's how much you have to trundle around the studio using only your knees and calf muscles. It's not the world's most glamorous job, but by the sound of it, Barnaby agrees, adding, I wouldn't have missed it for anything, though. As an operator, Barnaby's main tasks are to move the Dalek around, operate the gun and the sucker, and, quote, do that sexy little Dalek wiggle when it's speaking. with the voice-activated ear lights yet to be perfected, a fourth member of the gestalt of operators called Melvin Friend was required. Barnaby recalls that Melvin would click a button and flash the lights for every syllable uttered by Nicholas. Initially, we all thought it was going to be impossible to coordinate a coherent performance from so many disparate elements, but within a few hours, and much to our own surprise, we all fell into a mutually agreeable rhythm. So much so, in fact, that when Nick stumbled over his lines during one of the prison cell scenes and berated himself with a Dalek-intoned "Bugger!", Melvin flashed the lights, Mike moved the head, and I did the Dalek wiggle, all in perfect unison. I wish I'd seen that. I want to see that outtake. So, I think the Dalek performance is underrated in this, which is why I wanted to bring up what they were doing. And I can't really say much else other than that, yeah, you feel a lot for that Dalek, man, which is an unusual thing. But,
and it gets some really interesting close-ups. I mean, I know Daleks always get close-ups, but these are particularly in-your-face close-ups. You really still get feeling from it, which is quite surprising.
For sure, but that's why I was kind of critical of DK criticizing the direction, because I think Jordan didn't set a foot wrong. I think it was strong direction.
Fair enough. So, yeah.
I've never felt so much for a slimy monster of death.
Oh, wow.
You haven't seen some of my exes.
You've not been getting out enough, Toby.
We all made the same joke.
Same joke there, yes.
Anyway, so yeah, I mean, obviously, other than, the Dalek quartet, I guess you could call them, but especially Nick Briggs's voice performance, and the fact we've said, I mean, Eccleston is amazing in here. I mean, his raging against the Dalek, that's been lodged in my mind since 2005, the whole, I watched it happen, I made it happen, and some of the brutality of, like, well, why don't you just kill yourself and stuff, it's like, wow, but it's such a good performance anyway, you know, and the first hint of the kind of time war, PTSD, guilt, etc. I mean, other than that, what can you say? Billy Piper's great, very emotional, and makes you empathize, I think, with Rose as much as you can. And, Langley's fine for me, controversy aside, but I did like what Corey Johnson was doing. And, So, anyway, thoughts on the acting from you guys?
I did think Billy Piper was good. I remember when she was first cast, and everybody was like, really? I think she was... I'm not going to say revelation, but she turned out to be a really good actress, and you can see, especially in this episode, she got quite some range, and I loved the whole interplay with her and the doctor at the end. You know, it's not the one pointing the gun at me. What are you turning into, Doctor?
I kind of wish it hadn't come down to the Dalek needing the order from Rose and her doing it. I was just kind of just do it anyway. It's kind of it's I don't know. There's something really uncomfortable about her going, oh, go on then, kill yourself at the end. Like,
it's much more. I need my freedom, says the Dalek, and then goes, I'm going to die. Right, that's fine. That's the only freedom you can find. Oh, that's a bit harsh, isn't it?
Feel like a potential broken record, but I have to say it does handle that in the Target novelization a heck of a lot better. Yeah. So anyway, any thoughts on you from you, Toby, on the performances?
I think all necessary has been said. I mean, Eccleston is great, Billy Piper is great, Daleks are great. Everyone else is good enough.
Fair enough. So, DK, I'm going to move to the direction next because I don't really need to say it. I've got a little bit about, you know, they were all thrilled to see the Daleks finally flying, even though we knew they could and stuff, but this is all self-explanatory, so I won't bother with that. So do you have anything on the direction you wanted to throw in?
I've only got a couple of things. Just when it was released on DVD, the BBFC gave the episode a 12 rating just because of the scenes where the Doctor is seen to be torturing the Dalek. And
Yeah, apparently the Doctor's torture scene was Julie Gardner's request, as she felt the episode was a bit too macho and just wanted a shirtless Eccleston in it.
Yes, that seems fair.
But not super comfortable looking.
A belt.
Anyway. Supposedly Eccleston was having body image issues, though, which when you know that, it's kind of like, oh, Julie, did you really have to have that scene? I do like the scene, though. It's nice to have the kind of re-establishment of the, you know, two hearts, binary vascular system, I'm going to patent this, kind of thing. It's a nice enough scene, even though he is a bit arch Van Staten, maybe, but it works for me.
It's nice to have the juxtaposition of the Dalek and the Doctor being chained, it's nice to see that from Van Staten's point of view, they are just the same thing. They're just, this is part of my collection.
I did read that, like, when the Daleks weren't in the script for a while because they kind of they'd lost them because of the rights and they had to do a few rewrites, that became the impetus of one of the scripts was the idea that, like, okay, well, the Doctor's a living alien, so Van Staten's just going to be obsessed with capturing and torturing him because you can makes do that. Sense. So why not? I did read as well that when they had thought they'd lost the rights, that the draft script that Robert Sherman sent in was titled Absence of the Daleks, which I think was, again, beautifully petty, which I always like when somebody does something like that. But, cool. I mean, I have a few notes on the direction, but not many. I think it was great the way it was lit, staged and performed. I think I always loved the way that they reveal the Dalek from darkness with the whole, like, Doctor, the Doctor, and just the flashing light, I think, is superb. Like I said, the way that the Dalek POV is, the Doctor's kind of, like, spitting angrily at it, or the various slow zooms in. The extermination effect, being that kind of cool negative effect, is nice to see again, because that was one of the things when we watched Dalek Invasion of Earth for last week, DK, I think we were like, ooh, that effect really isn't quite there yet, is it?
No.
It didn't work at all.
I did like the little scene in this where it shows all the dead bodies under the sprinkler to like, you know, let it settle in a bit. Because just if, it, you know, you didn't think this episode was gruesome enough.
Here are some bodies.
Yeah.
Many a dead person here. But no, and I did like I said, it was nice to have all of the kind of things people criticize about the Daleks. So I did like that scene you mentioned of the bullets kind of evaporating in the Dalek shield or the plunger being used as a weapon. And obviously, you know, getting up the stairs was cool. So,
I've got to admit, watching it back, I'm really surprised how dated the CGI looks.
In part, it does. I think it does when it's...
Yeah, I know it's 20 years, but...
I agree with you. I found that when it was going up the stairs, it looked a little bit kind of photoshopped in, maybe. But then, weirdly enough, when it's kind of hovering, shooting the rain in that scene later, it looks fine. I was like, did they just actually suspend it from wires for this scene? Because it's in the middle of a big...
Why not?
Area, so you could, I guess.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, it's probably cheaper, to be fair.
Well, probably than CGIing it flying. Yeah. Now, I guess
at that time.
Cool. Yeah, right. What did I have here? Do you have anything on the VFX production design?
I've got a couple. The Daleks, the new design, it was designed so that the eye stalk met Billy Piper's eye level. And
she's not a tall woman, is she?
She's not. The prop used in this episode, which is known as MT1, obviously affectionately named after Mike Tucker, it was also used as Dalek Sec in both season 2 and season 3 before ultimately returning to bronze, where it appeared in a few episodes up until season 9, when not being recalled for use in the show, it now resides in BBC Birmingham alongside a TARDIS prop and Davros's head. And one for me, which I was completely delighted to learn, the helicopter that lands at the start is actually the exact same helicopter as that was used in Blue Thunder.
No way!
Yeah.
That's a cool little Easter egg, yeah. So do you guys have any thoughts whatsoever on anything else that you wanted to bring up before I go to the audience reaction and then wrap this thing up?
I think it looks, I think VFX wise, it looks okay. It you know, as Jill said, some of it doesn't look particularly great in bits, but it's forgivable. It's now 20 years old.
Yeah, exactly. It's 20. I mean,
I
think I was more surprised by my age than its age, shall we say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the only other thing I was going to say, I'll kind of paraphrase, is that it was Russell T who wanted kind of the idea of the Dalek mutant looking the way it did, because apparently Robert Sherman says he always imagined there was kind of a little man in there, like a miniature version of Davros, and Russell T Davies was like, no, it should be like an octopusy thing that looks horribly inhuman. Robert Sherman argued that the audience would not feel sympathy for a turd with tentacles or something, but then realized that Russell T was right, quote, as he usually is, the swine.
So, yeah. I think it's you know, it's surprisingly effective.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, as Russell T said when he kind of agreed on it, he said the inhumanity is the point. That's what sells it. If it was just, you know, if it looked human and you could relate to it easily, it's a shortcut, I guess, in a way that you don't need. So
yeah.
Anyway, cool. So why don't we start with we'll go to our audience's response, because I have a little bit. So I did ask on social media again what you thought of this episode. I didn't have a massive amount of responses, but I did have a couple. So I'll open the Subwave Network to everyone.
I'm transferring the Subwave Network.
And starting on the Facebook group Dalek Earth Force, Peter Bensley just says, brilliant, thumbs up. Gerard Timothy John Charmley says, this was one of the best episodes of the first series. It made the Daleks scary again. Matt Mullenby says, definite 5 stars, brought back an old favourite in a huge way. Russell Southern says, top marks, brilliant episode. On my personal Facebook, Perry Brooker says, brilliant episode, loved it. Jeremy on our Discord says, my favourite scene in the story is when the Doctor thinks he's lost Rose, and he tells Van Staten that all he wants to do is drag the stars underground beneath sand and dirt and label them. I'm not too keen on the shirtless scene, because I know Eccleston had severe body image issues, which we talked about. It's a great story that deals with how kindness and empathy can be an effective weapon against hatred. In the end, Rose's humanity killed the Dalek. 9 out of 10. Will Templar, I asked for his thoughts because he was on with us last week. He said, Dalek is an incredibly effective audio adaptation, though the Daleks merely going around the base shooting any and every soldier it could find does get a bit repetitive by the end. Not so much to give it anything less than a 9 out of 10, though. So I think that might be all. I didn't have a huge amount, but that's all I have yet for the audience feedback. So again, if you have any thoughts on this episode, feel free to leave them in our comments or any of our socials. Links will be provided at the end. And yeah, we're going to go back to our thoughts then. We're going to give our favourite character moment, line, and the conclusions and scores. So starting with the favourite character moment and line in the episode. DKA, I'm going to come to you because then it gives the guests time to think because they didn't know they had to do this.
It's the Doctor, obviously. Eccleston in this is phenomenal, I think. It's not necessarily the line, but the way he delivers the line. My favourite line is the, I saw it happen, I made it happen.
It is great, yeah. And it's powerful, because you don't know that at that point, so yeah.
No.
Couldn't agree more. So, was that your favourite line as well?
It is, yes.
And do you have a favourite moment?
The favourite moment is, I think, when you're first kind of introduced, when they're first introduced to each other, as you mentioned, the light on the top of its dome flashing in the darkness.
Yes, so good. Well, my favourite character, I actually went with the Lone Dalek, not because I particularly, you know, like the fascist or anything, but because honestly, it's such a unique portrayal and it just works. You hate it, you pity it, you sympathise with it. And like Rose, you're appalled at what it draws out of the Doctor. The performance leaves no doubt it's a wretched creature, completely alone with no idea of its place anymore. A victim in a strange, tragic way of its genetics, circumstances, and even its own nature, which frankly I find very relatable in that raw, uncomfortable way great writing sometimes is. My favourite moment was actually the Dalek elevating upstairs, because as I've said before, it was a great middle finger back to decades of dumb jokes. And my favourite line, you've already referenced earlier in the episode, it was Rose simply saying, he's not the one pointing the gun at me. I think that's when it kind of really hit home for me what was going on, as it did with the Doctor. It was a complete gut punch. So, Toby, favourite character in the story, please.
Favourite character? Rose. I'm going to go.
Okay. Rose, because... relatability, I guess, yeah.
I think Billie Piper is acting her ass off in this episode. She's so incredible.
She's good.
And I love all the subtleties she brings to this episode, and especially in the end, which is my favorite scene, when she talks to the Dalek with Eccleston standing behind her with a gun.
Yeah.
A little menacing, but okay.
Yeah.
No, I really like the scene. I really like her character, and especially how Billy Pepper's acting in this episode and in that moment. Line. Right. We need a line. My favorite line is...
You're looking it up.
It was a joke.
script for Dalek episode.
I can tell you my least favorite. But I think you guess that.
No, what was it?
The testosterone.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's just silly, isn't it?
And nerds.
Yeah, that's all I have. Do I need to give an overall?
No. I mean, we'll get to the conclusion and the score in the end, but okay. You don't need a favorite. If you have a least favorite quote, I guess we'll accept that.
Do I do an overall conclusion now as well?
No, we'll cut to that. We'll ask for everybody's in time, I'm sure. So, Gillian, did you have a favourite character in the story?
It's always the Doctor. on the rare occasions it isn't, it's always the Doctor.
I don't think he's very likable in moments of this episode, mind. I'll be
honest. No, which makes the character even more exciting.
True.
Yeah. You don't want a one-note character. I mean, those of you of a certain age, you know, the reason Blake isn't actually the best character in Blake 7 is because he is boringly heroic. You don't want a character like that. You want someone who is much more nuanced than that. And the Doctor has always been much more nuanced than that. And cool. It is the moments where he does something where you're going, whoa, hello, that really wake you up a bit and remind you why you love the character. And
fantastic.
Yeah.
Do you have really a favorite moment in the episode?
No. I think the moment I remember the best is when the Doctor says, "I've got to go and open something to save Rose." I can't remember the exact line, and everyone doesn't stop him. Literally, no one goes to stop him. You know, you'd at least think that someone would. Stop impressing.
It was a powerful moment when he says, I killed her once, I can't do it again.
Yeah, and exactly. And so it's, they literally stand there going, well, all right then. And that really stuck with me, is that they just go, okay.
By that point, they had two guards and Van Staten left alive, I think.
Yeah, but you at least one of them should possibly have gone, oh my God, stop.
We have 45 minutes, Jill.
fair point.
But, and do you have a favourite line?
I'm afraid I did not realise I needed a favourite line. Had I known, I'd have gone through it properly and written down some decent lines.
So, conclusion and score out of 5 stars. How should we do this then? Toby, we'll come to you first, I think.
Well, it's an incredible episode. No, that's it. No. I mean,
we've had shorter conclusions, to be fair.
Yeah.
did someone just give a score and then leave?
No, I think Will Templar at one point was like, fantastic, 4 out of 5. And I was like, that was your conclusion? He was like, yeah.
Fantastic, and it's 4 out of 5. So it's clearly point deduction we're not talking about. Okay.
Exactly, yeah.
Sure, why not? The loss of the Time Lord stuff, Time War stuff is done well in this episode. It adds a lot of nice depth to the Doctor as a character. And it's really well done, even for someone that, did not watch Classic Who, as a lot of people who watched this series first did not.
Of course, yeah.
And it's really well done in that aspect. Rose is incredible in this. I mean, Adam is what it is. It's not terrible. It's just kind of, okay.
Forgettable is the word, yeah.
I mean, Henry works well, and Henry Van Staten works well enough for what he's bringing to this episode, and everyone else is fine as well. I mean, the plot is really nice, and not nice in some of I like it. Not nice.
I know you mean.
Very pleasant.
La 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 la.
And I lost my thought. Anyway, the plot is great. Let's just
and I really well written. I think that's what you're saying.
I really like the 45-minute arc of the Dalek going.
Not both, yeah.
And moving on to.
Okay.
That's
arc. Yeah, okay, that's cool.
And the scene in the end is just brilliant, and brilliant shot, brilliant acting, brilliant everything. I don't know about the music. I don't notice that. But the rest.
Yeah.
The okay. scene, yeah, it's just so good.
So score out of 5 stars then.
Oh, 5.
5, awesome. Ooh. Fair enough.
I mean, it's the episode Dalek.
I know, yeah. I'm not.
I'm not going to give it a 5 out of 5.
Well, you'll see when I give my conclusion on Bloody Score, will you? So, Gillian, do you feel comfortable going next with your conclusion?
Yeah, yeah. It's a definite 5 out of 5. It's a very Thank strong you. Story. It knocks it well out of the park. It's great in reintroduction or introduction, doesn't matter mm-hmm. which, to the Daleks. Yeah, there's a lovely story arc for at least 3 of the main characters, which is pretty damn impressive for a 45-minute story. Even the minor characters, you know what they're about. Yes, the Adam character is a bit blonde and bland, and you don't really understand why Rose would fancy him. But I think that's half the fun is that, as you say, she's 19, she'll try anything once.
I think you kind of hit the nail on the head with forgettable, because I think I genuinely did forget
that
character existed for a while there.
He's an incredibly bland character, and... Yeah, but no, there's very little bad to say about Dalek.
Cool, awesome. So, DK, do you want to go next, or do you want me to go?
Yeah, I'll do it. I've not got much. It just basically says an episode that finally lived up to the promise of RTD helming this thing when it was first announced. It's well performed. It's got some fantastic moments, character moments, not just for the Doctor but for the companion and the antagonist. It introduces several layers into and what you would imagine is an already packed script, and a lot of the episodes that surrounding it could have done much better to be like this one. It's it really is a great episode, so I'm going to give it 5.
Awesome, cool. Right, I'll conclude with my conclusion then. If I can find it, I keep losing things today. There we go. Yeah. So I said, wow, just wow. Probably the single episode of Doctor Who I've watched more than any other, and it still lands like a gut punch. Eccleston gives his finest performance of the series. Piper absolutely breaks your heart, and every other actor wrings emotion from every line. Sherman's script is outstanding, sharp, affecting, and full of emotional depth. The episode demolishes the lazy claim that Doctor Who is just campy fluff. If I had to pick a single story to show someone what this series can truly be at its best, it would very likely be this one. The themes are so rich: survivor's guilt, racial hatred, the shifting line between good and evil, and on top of that, it throws in a scathing critique of the worst of humanity. The way it reframes the Doctor and the Dalek through brand new lore and makes it feel natural and shocking at the same time, that's a masterstroke. Who wasn't fascinated by the Time War after this? And let's talk direction. Joe Ahern made no false moves here. I could have applauded several choices outright. It's just stunning television. I could watch this a dozen more times. I could talk about it for hours. But if I had to sum it up in one word, perfection. Science fiction at its very best. And I also give it 5 out of 5. If I do the complex sums of adding that together. Oh, yes, that gives Dalek a final score of 5 out of 5. Our Hooray. Very first perfect score on the Doctor Who podcast here. Absolutely. So, yeah, congrats, Dalek. Perfect score. Not too shabby at all. So, turns out Doctor Who fans do like things sometimes.
No, we don't.
Only this episode. Only this episode.
Well, we got our consensus on this anyway, so that'll do.
It's just because I went to the cinema with Rob once. It's nothing personal.
Fair enough. Well,
lot of other people there. I mean, it wasn't just me and Rob.
Now it's not special anymore.
No.
Now you're gonna be the only person working on Blink, and I'm just not going to be interested anymore.
Sorry.
Anyway, that wraps up our deep dive into Dalek. Big thanks to all my guests for jumping into the Time Bunker with me today. It's been a blast dissecting this absolute turning point for the show. Before we go, I'll give everyone a chance to plug their stuff and where people can find you online, if anywhere. So, Toby, starting with you, are you still just on Blue Sky?
I'm still just on Blue Sky.
Fair enough. And that is Dark Sonic, yes?
Yes.
Awesome. Jill, do you have anywhere online people can find you? Any projects you want to plug?
If they're desperate, they can always find me. I'm just write my name in. It's spelled with a J, so it's really easy to find me on most things.
Do you have a surname? Because I just see Julie.
Oh, Speed. Sorry. Yes, it's Speed. Yeah, it is. Sorry.
Just checking. Okay. That's a very apt surname, by the way. I love it.
Well, you know, it's not difficult. I'm the sound assistant on Blink. Just look at the credits. It's a piece of piss. You can't miss it, really.
No, I was humble brag. Jeez.
Yeah. How many people on this podcast could just say, look at my IMDb?
So, DK, I'm guessing no is the answer.
No.
You don't want to plug any upcoming podcasts or anything?
Next episode of Cult Classics. Return of the Kill Tomatoes. Please watch it. Someone has to.
I will be. I'm tuning in. You know, got to have a bit of schlock every now and then. So, yeah, cool. And as for us, you know the drill. Follow Hit or Miss Doctor Who wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review if you're feeling generous. And let us know your thoughts on Dalek. Hit, miss, somewhere in between. Safe to say we called it a hit overall. Links to all our socials are on screen now if you're on YouTube, or they're accessible via our link tree, which is always in the episode description. Next episode, we're continuing our Dalek reviews and going even deeper as we head back to the 1970s or 80s or far future. Anyway, I'll be joining John Pertwee, UNIT, Ogrons, and a timey-wimey plot that even inspired the X-Men. So stay tuned for that. And until then, keep travelling, hopefully. And as the Doctor would say, allons-y. Allons-y!
You've been listening to the Hit or Miss Doctor Who podcast, part of the Hit or Miss Who Trek channel. Hit or Miss Doctor Who is hosted by Mike Wilson and DK. Behind the scenes and additional material by DK, scripted, produced, and edited by Mike Wilson. Adapted from an original podcast created by Will Templar. Follow us on YouTube, your podcatcher of choice, and our social media. Links to all of these can be found by clicking on the link tree in the episode descriptions. This podcast is a Media Matters original production. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share this podcast through all of time and space. We'll be back for another thrilling TARDIS trip soon, but for now, Doctor, I let you go.